free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what's our taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show on this Thursday, September 26, 2013. We've got Lou Rockwell coming up in a few minutes, so we'll get the chance to chit-chat with a hero of mine and somebody who played a very, very important role in my own intellectual development. So how much fun that will be. Yesterday, we had a chance to talk to Ian Anderson, and I was actually, in a way, kind of playing a trick on you guys, because I was actually out, so I had pre-recorded that show. So it seemed like I was in the office, and it was Wednesday, but it was actually Tuesday, because yesterday I was out on a field trip with one of my kids. We went apple picking to an apple thing, and I got 4 gallons of freshly made apple cider. I couldn't be happier, so I did that. We've got some retooling going on with the show. I want to, you know, I've got a super great setup. If you guys have ever heard me on Peter Schiff's show, it's just like it's like I'm in the next room. So I want to convey that. I want to get that type of sound quality here on the show. So I'm going to be retooling this, and probably by next week, you're going to tune in and say, "Oh my gosh, this is just like a dream." And I'm thinking of shifting to a pre-recorded show. It'll still be a daily show. I'll be recording a show every day. But I think I'm going to do it that way. I think that works a little bit better. And I can take audience feedback and questions in different kinds of ways. And very interestingly, I got a nice note. I've been having an email correspondence with Adam Curry. Now, if you're my age, which is years old, you'll recall from the 1980s, Adam Curry, the MTV VJ. And then he became like one of the pioneers of podcasting. So they actually call him the Podfather. And he wrote to say, "Look, I can walk you through this. It's no problem at all." And so we had a very nice exchange. He said, "I'm looking forward to your show." He was a Ron Paul supporter. So how about that, right? It's just, I got Ian Anderson. I got Adam Curry. What's going on here? I don't know. I had a couple of people saying, "I was a little surprised when you talked to Ian Anderson that you didn't ask him about politics or economics." And he does have a couple of songs that in his most recent album that deal with economics. And why didn't you do that? And I guess it's because I'll be perfectly honest with you. I really don't care what his views on economics are, right? I mean, what's his specialty? Especially his music. So I'm not really that interested in what he has to say. I mean, maybe he has something interesting to say. I don't know. But here's somebody I've been following for 25 plus years. I have 15 to 20 minutes to talk to him. I don't want to spend that time arguing with him, right, or being disillusioned or anything. I want to talk about what he specializes in. And I'll have Bob Murphy come on and talk about the economy and central bank, or have Mark Thornton or somebody like that. But I'm especially glad to be able to talk to Lou Rockwell today, simply because of my own experiences. Like I was some of you know my story, but I was a college kid who didn't really know up from down, pretty much. I was a moderate Republican. That's like the worst possible thing you could be. So I didn't really care that much about government spending, but I did want to fight a lot of wars. Scratch that. I wanted other people to fight a lot of wars, and I wanted to watch them on TV. That was pretty much where I was. And I think I was not alone. I get a lot of people telling me they had the same experience. They went through the same sort of growth. And the Mises Institute, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which Lou Rockwell founded, was really the key for me. And this was the key thing that changed. It got me onto the right kind of path, that I didn't wind up growing up and still listening to Rush Limbaugh, and not changing at all. That was a liberating thing for me, because good grief, 20 years ago, 1993, I'm flipping through a magazine. Like in the old days, we used to have magazines. You would hold them in your hand and flip through them and read articles. And I saw an ad in that magazine for the Ludwig von Mises Institute's Mises University week-long summer program. And I thought, wow, remember, you're dealing with the world's biggest dork, a week-long summer program on economics. I thought, well, I'm sold, man. Where do I sign up for this thing? So I, got out my little envelope and please send me your brochure and mail it to them. Again, that's exactly how I would have done it in the year 1897. So little had communications changed. And sure enough, I get the information, I get accepted, and they say, all right, here are the few that we've got, right? Here are the few required readings you've got to read. Got to read these few readings. And then if you're really ambitious, here's a list, as long as your arm, going down the line of recommended readings. So, okay, I'll do that too. So I wound up reading all the recommended readings. And so by the time I got to the Mises Institute for that program, well, I was like dork times 1,000, basically. By the time I got there, I had read pretty much all the articles on that list, and they were all written by, or I don't know, maybe half of them were written by faculty at the program. So I was going up to Tom DiLorenzo and saying, hey, I read your article on antitrust. Like, I was the biggest kiss up you've ever seen in your whole life. And that really paved the way for me to be able to do the things that I wound up doing later on. I mean, I had the confidence because I had studied with these people. So this is why it'll be nice to be able to chat with Lou today, because it was the fact that he did this at great personal expense and with very much of a struggle. He put this institution together, and I was able to benefit from it. And now, 20 years later, now I get to go in there and talk to people who are exactly in the situation I was in 20 years ago, except the difference is these kids have Mises.org. And so they come into the Mises programs and they already, they sort of know 25% of the stuff already. That's an astonishing development to me. In fact, I guess it was probably, 2-3 years ago, maybe a little longer. We want to put out a new edition of Human Action, right? The great treatise by Mises, right? 1,000 pages. A 1,000-page treatise by Mises, and we were going to do that. It was going to be super great, but we still had these old ones, right? We have these old Mises books, so we want to clear those out so we can produce the good Mises books, the brand new ones, the beautiful, beautiful Human Action edition. So we put a little note up there saying, "Hey, everybody. We're going to give away Mises books for $15. $15 for your copy of Human Action." So, all right, we do that. If we say it's going to be $15, and it basically, the response we got basically shut the website down. Basically shut it down because kids about 18 to 25, kids about that age, were pretty much trampling over their own grandmothers to get access to this book. So now the Mises.org website is like super powerful, right? It can do pretty much anything. It can take traffic from 8 gazillion people. So for the Mises Institute website to be pretty much wrecked by demand for a $15 Human Action was one of the most delightful pieces of news I've gotten in a long time. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I live in this world. I cannot believe this is a world that I live in. So anyway, so that's wonderful stuff. Now I think, let's see, I'm getting a little news here. All right, I think I'm going to shift gears because I may actually not be able, I may not be able to get Lou today. So what I think I'm going to do instead is by popular demand, last week, when I was hosting the Peter Schiff Show, I finally got around to this absolutely hideous article that all your friends were reading, right? And they were all sending it to you saying, this smashes you for all time, you libertarians, and ha, ha, ha. And if you're like me, you open up articles like this, and you find that the person writing it doesn't even understand the libertarian position, right? And so it's this article, you guys remember it, this article, it's called 11 Questions to See if Libertarians are Hypocrites. You guys remember that article? So I finally had time. I don't really have time, unfortunately, to write written responses to these articles a lot. Sometimes I still do over at my blog at tomwoods.com, but not a lot, just because I'm spending so much time on this Ron Paul homeschool program. I mean, I am doing, for every single course, I'm doing 180 videos. You know, you do a few courses, that adds up after a little while. So that's taken away some of my writing. I still try to blog at tomwoods.com. But so the show gives me the opportunity to just talk, right? Just talk about articles that come up, and people are already sending me articles that need to be refuted. Please do that. I can't necessarily respond to all the emails just because I have a pregnant wife and she's sick and I got to take care of her. I got four other kids. I got all these things going on. I almost don't have a secretary, basically, but they're gratefully received. So please keep sending those. But I want to be able on this show to answer articles like this, to just go through it, show what the problems are, or have people come on and go through them with me. So I do want to get this down, because when I did it on the Peter Schiff Show, you know, we have a two-hour show. You know, I guess how does that slogan go? That work always expands to fill the time allotted for it. So the longer you have for something, you still find that up to the last minute you're working on something, no matter how early you got started. You know, you're up to the last minute, you're working on it. So I think the same thing goes with this. On the Peter Schiff Show, I just like spent the whole show talking about this article. So this is going to be discipline, right? I'm going to take like the next 15 minutes and see if I can just get to the real meat of this thing. So the article was from Alternet, you know, which is 99% bad. And then it appeared on Salon. It's by this guy, R.J. Escow. I looked him up, but now he doesn't have a whole lot that really redeems him. So he's talking about what he calls the libertarian hypocrisy test. And he quotes from the Cato Institute's overview of the idea of spontaneous order. And he reads this. This is from the Cato Institute. Order in society arises spontaneously out of the actions of thousands or millions of individuals who coordinate their actions with those of others in order to achieve their purposes. Now, the problem right here is that that's a bad definition of spontaneous order. Spontaneous order, which is not by any means necessary to libertarianism, but spontaneous order is the idea that without some guy in charge, great things can happen. And so the examples that I've given and that Bob Murphy has given would be like the English language that emerged spontaneously. There was no language czar who developed the English language, or the academic discipline of physics. There's no guy running physics. It just occurs. It's just people spontaneously doing scholarly work, and then they work together with each other to make sure that the good work is promoted and the bad work is not, and then you advance in physics. So that's the idea, or the classic example of the making of the pencil. That's spontaneous order. Why is that spontaneous order? Because, yeah, there's a guy in charge of the wood production, and there's a guy in charge of the getting the graphite, but there's no guy in charge of saying, all right, everybody, I've gotten hold of all world production, and so now I'm going to tell you that you guys have to produce wood, and you guys have to make the paint, and you guys – there's nobody doing that. And when you consider all the difficulties that are associated with making paint, the long production process, and all the other things you need rubber for tires, you need gasoline for the car to transport the paint from one place to another, and each one of those things has a very involved and complicated production structure, it is unbelievable that there's no guy in charge of this whole thing. This all occurs spontaneously. So the key element of spontaneous order, the key element is that there's no coercion involved. That's what's got to be in a definition of spontaneous order. There's no coercion. It's not like libertarians just like spontaneity. It's not that. It's not that I love people who are spontaneous or or libertarians really, really like it when the spouse comes home and says, hey, you know what, spur of the moment, let's go out for dinner. That's not what we're talking about here. Spontaneous order is the idea of non-coerced order. And so because he gets this wrong, half of his so-called hypocrisy questions are all – the premise behind them is all wrong. So his first question is, are unions, political parties, elections, and social movements like Occupy examples of spontaneous order? And if not, why not? Well, we'll start with political parties and elections first. No, of course they're not spontaneous order, because they wouldn't occur in the absence of coercion. If there weren't a state, there wouldn't be political parties. If there weren't a state, there wouldn't be elections. And these things are all geared toward coercive outcomes. I'm a politician. I'm going to tell you how I'm going to coerce you in order to bring about wonderful results. I'm going to tax you in this way. I'm going to regulate you in this way. They're all about non-spontaneous. That's not spontaneous. The spontaneous in spontaneous order involves non-coercive institutions. So, of course, now the election of your chess club president, for example, I suppose that's spontaneous, but that's not – the idea of spontaneous order is that the order that comes out has to be kind of impressive and neat, and you wouldn't expect that without coercion you could get pencils or you could get physics or you could get the English language. But I don't know, like what's so impressive about the election of a chess club president? Like I don't – just a bad example. Social movements like Occupy. Well, yeah, I guess that's spontaneous order, but like, is it really impressive that a whole bunch of people just go places and sit there? Like, sorry, but I think a pencil is more impressive than that. So yeah, sure. I don't see any libertarian who would deny that. But then he asks, are unions, are labor unions examples of spontaneous order? Because he then spends the next couple of questions on this misconception, that unions are just wonderful, peaceful institutions by which people aim at improving their material welfare. That's all unions are, right? They're just spontaneous, wonderful little things, and libertarians just arbitrarily hate them, even though they're supposed to like them because they're spontaneous. But again, it's not because they're spontaneous that a libertarian would like them. They like them because they're non-coercive. And as Henry George said, you are about as likely to encounter a union that functions just with persuasion alone as you are to encounter a tiger who lives on oranges. Excuse me. So that's why unions don't qualify, because you've got two aspects of unions that are coercive. One is the American version of unionism, which involves the single exclusive bargaining agent. So once 51% of a group of workers decides to unionize, everybody has to pay dues. Everybody has to be represented by that one institution. And even after everybody who voted for it is dead, it is never required to stand for a re-election of any kind. Never. It just persists into the future. Well, this takes away people's individual right to decide what they want to do. Do I want to be represented by this thing? Do I want to pay dues to this thing? But that's the law. Now, most countries don't have exclusive representation. That's just the United States and Canada. Most countries have proportional representation. If this percent wants to be represented by this union, then they are. This percent wants to be represented by that union, then they are. If some percent doesn't want to have the hassle of any union at all, and they'll just negotiate on their own, they can do that. But and in fact, even Franklin Roosevelt didn't like the idea of exclusive representation. So that's the situation. That's why it's not an example of spontaneous order. But then the other problem is the law requires that in some cases employers hire back people who have gone on strike even if they engage in violence. And the National Labor Relations Board will determine which cases are cases of violence that are so great that it would disqualify the that you wouldn't have to hire him back. But they have excused unbelievably violent behavior, hurling brick bats at people, threatening non-strikers' families, beating up people, like beatings, stabbings have been considered to be not bad enough as to disqualify someone from being rehired. So again, this is violence. And then when I was on the Schiff show, I quoted Edward Chamberlain talking about if we were dealing with the type of privileges that a labor union has, and we apply them to somebody involved in buying a house, Well, he would be in a position where he could say to the house owner, you can't take bids for this house from anybody else. We can prevent normal commerce from taking place to and from your house. And we have there's a whole long list of things that when you hear them applied to any other situation, you would say, well, this is an atrocity. But when it's labor unions, we say, well, you know, that's sort of okay. So they're not examples of spontaneous order. So no, we're not being hypocrites to not support them. The next question is a libertarian willing to admit that production is the result of many forces, each of which should be recognized and rewarded? I mean, I don't want to call names here, right? I don't want to be like that. But that's just a dumb question, right? If you read any libertarian or Austrian literature, of course we believe in the division of labor. And we believe in economic calculation. We believe in the price system by which we find out, well, this is the value of this contribution to the production process. And we find out exactly, well, we've got workers, we've got different stages of production, we've got raw materials, we've got all these different sorts of inputs, and every one of them has its role. And every one of them should be recognized, but not rewarded. It's not like the production process is a Sunday school with rewards. It's that the normal process of buying and selling and abstaining from buying gives rise to an array of prices and wages in line with the contribution to the production process of that particular thing or that particular person. So of course we agree with this, but we're thinking at it at a level much higher and more sophisticated than at Solon. Not that that's too difficult. Is our libertarian willing to acknowledge that workers who bargain for their services individually and collectively are also employing market forces? Yes, as long as they bargain without violence, without the threat of violence, and as long as everybody's allowed to accept an offer of work that is made to him. If the Solon / alternate person is willing to accept that, then we agree completely. If he thinks that instead violence or threats of violence are acceptable, then we don't agree because we, being libertarians, we're against violence. Does our libertarian believe in democracy? If yes, explain what's wrong with governments that regulate. Okay, and then before that, is our libertarian willing to admit that a free market, and I put that in quotation marks, of course, because we know the free market exists only in our heads, that a free market needs regulation? No, I'm not willing to accept that. Nope, I do not admit that. Most times people think about regulation, these are matters that can easily be handled in the private sector, or they're areas where the government has screwed them up so much that then after the fact you feel like regulation. The government has screwed up banking so much that, yeah, now we kind of feel like, okay, you do need to regulate what banks can do because the government is guaranteeing the deposits. Well, the problem is the government guarantee of the deposits. It's nothing wrong with the free market itself. It's the government guarantee of the deposits makes the banks act in ways they wouldn't act if they were on a free market. So, I mean, I talk about this. I have a book called Rollback where I have a whole section on regulation and some of the misconceptions about that. But yeah, I would debate that anytime. But does our libertarian believe in democracy? What we believe in is private property and the right to your body and to your private property. And if democracy supports that, then great. If it doesn't, then we don't support it. That's it. What we favor is peace. And nobody aggressing against anybody else. We don't say, well, we favor peace and we favor non-aggression unless people vote to aggress. Then it's okay. How does voting make something immoral moral? Like, what is this fetish about voting? Like, that legitimizes immorality. Of course, it doesn't. Let's see. Well, I don't know if I have time to get to that one, so we'll skip. I did them all on the Peter Schiff show, but... Does our libertarian recognize that democracy is a form of marketplace? Yes, I do, but it's the crummiest marketplace ever. It is, because at least in the free market, it doesn't matter if nobody else or if, let's say, 90% of the public hates your musical taste. There could still be a niche for you, right? Because the market is big enough that even if most people don't like it, you can still get the music you like. Or if you're the only type of person or – you know, there's just a small sliver of the public that likes a particular type of food. It's not like we say, all right, we're going to take a vote, everybody, and if 51% of the people say we're having hamburgers, that it's going to be hamburgers and the rest of you 49% can just forget about it. No, no, no. The market is a form of marketplace. Instead of saying the democracy is a form of marketplace, say marketplace is the best kind of democracy, where you get to vote with your dollar bill and you get anything you want. Whereas in democracy, it's, well, 51% get what they want and everybody else just has to suck it up. So imagine if that was the kind of marketplace what we lived in. We'd have no classical music. That would be gone completely. Many of the TV channels we enjoy would all be gone. Many of the movies would be gone. Whatever. There are a ton of books that you would not have any access to because everybody's reading Tom Clancy. And that was the vote. So what kind of marketplace would that be? In the market, you don't have to say, well, it's winner take all, and whatever the people decide, I have to learn to live with. No, everybody, if you have a dollar bill, you can go get what you want. Somebody will cater to you. So that's vastly preferable. Okay, then I want to skip to the extra credit questions because I'm good at these. You know, I was a dork in school. Like, I was the kid who got 106 on the test, right? So let's see. If you believe in the free market, why weren't you willing to accept as final the judgment against libertarianism rendered decades ago in the free and unfettered marketplace of ideas? All right, two answers here. One is, I just said that in a free and unfettered market, we don't say that, like, the loser gets nothing. Well, most people don't like classical music, so you're just a loser, and you get no music at all. That's not how it works. Well, same thing with libertarianism. Even if people don't like that system, that doesn't mean we can't still believe in it. It's not like, well, people have rejected it, so you're not allowed to think it anymore, because in democracy, we get one way to think. No. No, like I just explained, that stinks. No one would want to live that way. But also, what free and unfettered marketplace of ideas? You mean the one that we see in the government's own schools? As it turns out, by an amazing coincidence, the government's own schools promote government propaganda. The government's own schools teach you that you are a big fat loser who wouldn't be able to support himself if it weren't for the wise government officials whose faces are looking down at you from up on the wall. That's what kids are taught. Oh, in big business, they get these photos of kids working in mines as if that wasn't a function of how poor the society was. No, that's a function of the wickedness of capitalism, which is the only institution in the history of the world that ever made progress against child labor, ever. So do kids actually get a chance? Do they get a chance to consider different alternatives? Of course not. They are never given that chance. So there is no free and unfettered marketplace of ideas when it comes to stuff like this. All right, look, that's my overview here of the 11 questions. All right, so it turns out we're not hypocrites after all. You don't have to worry about it. So that's that. All right, remember this week, libertyclassroom.com is my site where I, along with other people, teach history and economics the way it ought to be taught, and where you can learn the real stuff that you didn't get in school in your car. That's the free and unfettered marketplace of ideas. And in fact, it's even more unfettered than usual, because this week, for you guys who are sticking by me and listening into the program, 60% off with coupon code SHOW in all caps, like you're shouting SHOW, as indeed maybe you are during the day. Like, when is the next episode of the Tom Woods Show coming? So libertyclassroom.com, coupon code SHOW. And don't forget the Ron Paul homeschool program that I am killing myself to make courses for. RonPaulHomeschool.com is the site for that. And don't miss Dr. Paul tonight. That's fun. All right. Tomorrow.
Tom Woods Show.